There was a CAA convention in Atlanta, Georgia. I can't remember what year this was. It was 2011 or 12. And my home group at the time, Spearheads, we were doing a big book workshop at this convention. And, you know, convention workshops are, you know, when there's marathon meetings, you know, you get some audience, then it drops and it goes back up. And but there was this guy that sat in the back of, I think, almost every one of our sessions and was engaged, and he walked up to us at the front afterwards and told us how awesome it was, and, you know, he was so glad he was there. Turns out he was the keynote speaker of the convention on Saturday night. It was Mr. Terry Murphy, and I've gotten to spend a lot of time with a lot of these speakers over the years, and I know this is being recorded, but I'm going to go ahead and say it anyway, that I don't really care for the majority of them, well over half of them. A lot of them have wonderful messages, but they're not people I'd want to spend any time with. This man came to Atlanta in 2017, and we sat in my condo and had absolutely the most beautiful time just talking. He's one of my sponsor's favorite people. And then this morning, I got to meet his lovely wife, Donna. And their hearts are so open, so inviting, that I can't wait for you guys to hear their stories. And with that, I give you Mr. Terry and Donna Murphy.
Wow. All right, so I'm Donna.
Hi, Donna.
And just kind of a little bit about the two of us. We're going to bounce back and forth a little bit. We've been married for 46 years. Yeah, we're both very active in our programs of recovery. And he's got 33 years sober. So you can do the math. There was quite a bit of time where we lived in the madness, you know. So we met when I was 18. We got married when I was 19. It was really, really quick, less than a year.
I was young too, though, just sort of like
You know, we've lived through business failure, addiction, bankruptcy, cars repoed, IRS problems, the loss of a child, infidelity, separation, raising kids, teenager with drug addiction problems, economic downturn, health problems, career challenges. So you can see we've lived our life absolutely to the fullest with the good and the bad. And so now it's your turn.
Thank you. All right, so I'm Terry and I'm an addict. As Donna said, my sobriety date's May the 23rd, 1991, and that is not the most important day of my life. August 5th, 1978, when I married her, is not the most important day of my life. December 25th, 1955 was the beginning date, but that wasn't the most important day of my life. The most important day of my life was May the 19th, 4 days before I got sober. And in that day, someone worked their 12 step on me. And what happened in that is it sent my life, you know, the great Mark Twain said the two most important days are the day you're born and then the day you discover why. Mm-hmm. And even though I still had some crack to smoke and some liquor to drink in those 4 days, that was the most important day of my life. So how did a nice guy like me end up there? I'm 1 of 10 kids. I'm second to the youngest. Incredible parents, right? My mom and dad worked really hard to be good people. I remember going to church on Sundays and my mom would be at the front and all 10 kids and then my dad at the back of the line. We'd walk in like that and take our row in church. And I remember this one memory. I'm walking into church and the priest was... They scared me, right? They were always, the way they talked, it just freaked me out. And as we're walking in, I hear him talk about, what's wrong with you people? He was an Irishman. How can you not come in? You come in late. How can you do this in God's house? He asked for 1 hour a week, and he's saying all this shit as we walk in late. And then he acknowledges us. The whole church is stunned silent. I'm petrified. And he turns, he goes, why, good morning, Mrs. Murphy. Please take your regular row. And the rest of you, if you have 10 children, you can come in whenever you want. So I was raised with right and wrong. I was raised with morals and values, and I was raised to party hard. My brothers and sisters, my mom and dad, drinking, music, lively experiences. All of my brothers and sisters hit it hard like I did, but I'm the only addict. Donna hit it hard like I did. Donna has shot more dope than most junkies. She is, she's so Donna's got her own experience, but she's not an addict. There's a difference, right? All of my siblings and my wife all loved to party, but they all had this thing that I didn't have. And that was the ability to stop. It was like, it would get late, and they go, okay, well, I got to go to work in the morning. Are you kidding me? Right? You know, we still have a stereo we can pawn. I mean, it was different for me. It was different for me. So my... I'm also a child addict. I was busted and betrayed as a child. And I'm going to start our journey through the steps, which is what we're going to do. We're going to cover the 12 steps over these sessions. But we're going to tell stories that relate to each of these steps. So we're going to begin with this one. I'm a good kid. I love my mom. I love my dad. I'm a good athlete. I can hurdle. I love to chase the clouds. I felt so free. And then my mom got sick with cancer when I was 11. My world started shaking. You know, the world started shaking. It was the 1960s. Drugs were everywhere. My siblings were getting high. I remember going into my room, and my brother was passed out on the floor, one of my older brothers, and there were all these little, what I thought were red hot candies laying on there. But it was, all dope. Just everywhere around us, it was happening. And my mom, when I needed her the most, was sick. And so after I got sober, my boys were 7 and 3. I had one prayer. My one prayer, and God already answered that. And the prayer was that I could live long enough, that we could live long enough to get my kids through high school. Because I know what a wound that ripped in me. I didn't know I was experiencing a wound, because you can hide a lot of stuff behind drugs and alcohol. So I'm loaded at school, I overdose in school, and I start projectile vomiting, and I'm trying to write a paper. And every time I write, I drop the pen, and I'm trying to write. It was literally, you would buy, in my day, we would buy the drugs from the ice cream man. There was a drug called Seconal Reds. It was a drug that has no useful purpose. It's not around anymore. All you do is you take it, and they call them stumblers, right? And then you could get... it was called a rack of reds. You could get 4 for $1, or you could get 10 white crosses, Benzedrine speed, 10 for a buck. So I go up to get the ice cream man. Oh yeah, let me have an ice cream bar, and can I get some reds and some whites? And so I'm at school and I'm overdosing. If I gave any man in here or woman in here one red, they would fall out. But I built up a tolerance to those things so fast, I'm taking 3 and 4 of them at school. And so I get just this horrible experience. The next day I get back to school. They don't really know what's going on. The world isn't ready for child addicts. Hell, it isn't ready for them now either. And so they said, listen, one of the other boys said that you've been doing drugs. And if you tell us the truth, we will not tell your mother. Because that poor woman we know is dying of cancer, and we do not want to add to her suffering. And I sat there, you know, and I already knew a little street hood, right? You don't ever tell the truth. Don't ever admit. Don't. But I would do anything for her. And I said, yes, sisters, I did. So I told them that, and they said, good, the truth will set you free. That's what it says in the Bible. And I walked out. When I got off the school bus that day, my mom said, come here, I got to talk to you. She took me back into the laundry room where she was ironing all the clothes for 10 children. And she said, the sisters came by today, and they told me my son is a filthy doper. She said, the shame you brought on me, I can't tell your father because he'll beat you to death. And even though you deserve that, I need him to feed the rest of these children. She said, the shame you have brought on me, the shame you brought on your father, the shame you brought on your sister Kathy and your brother John and your brother Jim and your sisters Rita and Maura and Colleen and Brian and Michael and Kevin. And then she said to me, you're going to carry this secret to your grave, and I'm going to carry it to mine. a grave you had put me in early. Now get out of here, you make me sick. Whew. Holy shit. I didn't know what to do with those feelings other than walk down the street to where my friends were drinking and smoking. So that's where, so I learned a couple things. Don't trust God, don't trust authority. I know my own story. And my disease uses my story against me all the time. You know, you read your Miranda rights, right? Well, my disease should have read me mine. Because what my disease would do is it would tell me, I know who you are. I know the truth about you. You ain't nothing but nothing. And then I have to learn in these rooms to develop a different voice. But for all my life, I only had the voice of the damned going off in my head. You're a failure, you're a disappointment. Get out of here, you make me sick. So I go through my life. My mom dies, carried it to her grave, and I go about the business of experiencing life, which quickly finds me having to flee, and I was able to get into the military instead of prison. It's the end of the Vietnam War. I did not go to Nam, I went to Germany. And I get over to Germany, and I found this thing. Well, drug addiction was new in the military. They didn't know what to do, so they started shipping all the junkies out of Nam into Germany. And literally, you could look up at the barracks and see the puke stains out of a lot of the windows to know that's how much dope there was in those days. And so somebody said to me, whatever you do, stay away from Shitty Smitty. Of course, right away, hey, why'd they call you that? Oh, man, I don't know. And he's all smacked back. So I started very quickly doing heroin. Anybody else ever done heroin? So you know you don't do it for long. You do it and it does you. So heroin started doing me, and I'm going to touch on a couple of the lowlights. So I found myself in a train station in the middle of the night with no place. I'd missed the last train to the barracks. It's 3 a.m. I got a syringe. I got heroin. I'm starting to need the dope. And I got to shoot up. So I go check the men's room. It's locked. The women's room's open. There's nobody in this train station. Nobody's in the bathroom. I go to turn the water on. The water doesn't work. Oh, great. So I figure I'll take the lid off the back of the toilet. Not that kind of toilet. This was an industrial toilet in a train station of a city of 300,000. And it wasn't flushing. And so there was a mountain of turd. Literally, the bowl's here. There's a mountain of turd and a piss moat. And I looked at that liquid and I thought, And I drew that liquid up, right, to cook my dope, and I told myself that the fire would kill the germs. Now, I will tell you, I was 19 years old. That's not normal. Neither is taking 4 reds in the 8th grade. Needless to say, that didn't work out well. Next thing you know, I'm thrown out of the military in disgrace. I come back to the States, and I find myself. You know, I come back to the States determined to do better, but not knowing that the needed power wasn't there. So I go from one problem to next, right? Next thing you know, I discovered this new drug, right? I met her. I swept her off her feet. I was her knight in shining armor, man. And then we started off to Texas to start our own company. And I told her, baby, stick with me. We're gonna do it all. But when I met her, I married her within 8 months. Now, that was one of the smartest things I ever did because it was more like I knew I had to book her into custody because I already knew there was this thing in me that caused me to, I don't know if y'all could relate, build it up, tear it down. Build it up, tear it down. That's what I've been doing my whole life, right? And so I knew I had to get her into custody. So I'm idealistic young man, long hair. We're going for it. Let's go for it. Peace, love, power to the people. I start my own company. It's wildly successful, and I discover this new non-addictive drug called cocaine. Oh man. So I start smoking that cocaine. Not smoking that cocaine, excuse me. You know that would be the end of the story. When you start smoking cocaine, that's always the end of the story. So I start snorting this non-addictive drug, and we're in the clubs, right? We are family. Well, it's ladies' night. And the feel, you know, I mean, damn, it was all on. We were having the time of our lives, right? And then I get into a barroom brawl, and some dude breaks my nose, and I could no longer snort this non-addictive cocaine. Damn, out comes the syringe. But this time, I'm not going to go to get a regular syringe. I'm going to go to the veterinarian place. My wife was a vet tech. They got these big-ass syringes because, you can get syringes there. So I get this syringe. I start, man, I built this company up from nothing. We built it up together. 4 retail stores, a manufacturing plant. I drive a turbo Porsche, a boat, a van conversion. I buy her a BMW for Christmas. Everything on credit. We don't own shit, but we are rolling. But we are rolling. And then I put that needle in my arm again. And instantly my world changed, right? So I'll share this one with you. I'm in one of my stores now in the middle of the night. In the beginning, the drugs and alcohol connected me to you in a beautiful way. And we're rolling. And then in the end, it was just me alone with the dope or the drink. And I'm sitting there and I'm slamming dope. And I'm paranoid in the vents or where the people lived. And so I am in one of my stores in the middle of the night. I'm going to give you right out of our book a vision for you. A camera drops out of the vent. Oh, great. I'm under surveillance. And then I look up, and these little SWAT guys are rigging up about that big. And I think, they're coming in. And then I think to myself, well, I better step on them while they're little. Is that murder? Just saying, I hear them coming for me, right? I hear them coming, so I turn around and boom, I punch a hole in the wall. I drop the syringe down in the wall. I held on to the dope. I always held on to the dope. So I'm in there, and I can hear the police dog. I can see the lights. One out of 12. Holy shit. So I start to calm down, and I realize they're gone. They've probably gone for reinforcements because I'm such a badass. And so I figure I better do the last of this evidence. So cocaine used to literally come in these little brown bottles, right? So I put water on it. I shook it up. I drew this. I punched the hole and dropped the rig in the wall. I punched the hole at the bottom. I pulled my rig out. I filled the rig with cocaine. Damn, where's the needle? There was no needle. Oh, yeah. We stood at the turning point. So I rip out all the drywall between the top hole and the bottom hole. I can't find it. I cannot find the needle. It's not there. I figured the bastards in the vent moved it. So here I am with my first moral inventory. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I got a syringe full of cocaine, no way to do it. I start running down my options. First one is I can squirt it in my mouth, save it till tomorrow. Yeah, no, no. And then I hear this voice say, just shove it up your ass. That is not my story. Nothing goes in my ass. And then I hear, just shoot up without a needle. So I got the hole right there. You can still see it. Boom! I bled a lot. I don't know if I got high, but I remember. But it didn't really matter there. So needless to say, I go from my custom home and turbo Porsches in our house on a golf course to living back in Donna's parents' house in her childhood bedroom. I'm a roller. I'm a baller. Stick with me, baby. And so on it goes, right? May 19th, 1991, I'm standing in a pawn shop. I'm convinced that the only way out for me is to commit suicide. And it's not being dramatic. It's because I hate me. I hate the fact that I have sworn on the Bible, I'll never do it again. I've sworn on the lives of my children. I've sworn on my dead mother's grave, on everything sacred, and then I still use. And I know there's no way to stop. I've tried. I beg God. I've stopped many times, but here's what I know. My life gets worse when I stop. My life gets significantly worse when I stop. That's when the Jones, the withdrawals, and the kicking, and all that stuff comes in. So I'm in this place where I'm convinced I'm going to kill myself. And so I go and I pound my Bose speakers in the morning, and later that day it's on me. You know what I mean? When it's on you, where you've got to get the next one, you've got to get it no matter what, where my wedding ring went for a $20 rock, where my kids' college education money went, where their piggy banks went, where my Bose speakers were fixing to go. And I told the man, I said, dude, I said, I got to tell you what, man, I don't want those speakers. I'm just going to sell them to you. And the guy looked at me and he said, dude, I don't know if you're in trouble or not. There was a song, and the song went like this. Send me an angel right now. I've been praying, God, take me, save me, something, right? And this man in the pawn shop looks at me and goes, dude, I don't know if you're in trouble or not, but I used to be in trouble. The minute he opened his mouth, though, dude, I don't know if you're in trouble, my mind went boom. It was ready to slam shut like the gates of hell, because I have had good talkings to by the best of them. Why do you do this? How come you're so self-destructive? What about your beautiful wife and those kids? Why? If I knew the answer, I would have changed things. But what was different is he flipped it on me and he started talking about himself. What does it say in our book? An alcoholic armed with the truth about himself can go where nothing else could go. When my dad beat me with the strap to change me, and my mom shamed me, and Donna loved me, nothing worked. But this man spoke into my soul. And he said, I went to this place, it's called Lark, it's the South End, you're just on the South Runway, and it's a building freestanding, you go right up. He was drawing a mental mind map. I didn't know what was happening. I was in a moment of grace. God had sent me that angel, but guess what? You know what I was doing? I was judging him. Because I'm thinking to myself, oh, if I let this poor bastard preach a while longer, maybe I'll get an extra 20 for my Bose speakers. And so he's sitting there going off about that he went there and got sober and got a sponsor, worked the steps, and his life changed. And he said, man, and I own this pawn shop and everything in it. And then he smiled and he said, you know, a lot of it used to be yours. But I was judging him. In the middle of the most important moment of my life, I was judging him. And the reason I tell that with you is because it doesn't matter what my intention is, it's my action. God did not withdraw his love for me. God poured it on me. But so I went to that place. I called Donna, said, I'm turning for treatment. Next thing you know, man, in a series of events, I am sober a few days. And then I get this voice in my head. Dude, you threw that crack pipe out in that field. It had another hit in it. Just then they announced, meeting next door. I got up and followed them all out, 4 days sober. They all turned right to go to Bill Wilson Hall. I turned left to go to the field. I crawled around on my hands and knees. I found that pipe. We can always find the pipe. You can always find the straw, the needle, the bottle. It's everywhere. I stuck it in my waistband. I pulled the stickers out of my hair. I walked back into that place. I go, you don't look out, because I don't feel good. I go back into the med ward where I'm wearing hospital clothes and paper slippers, and I go in this bathroom with a steel mirror, and I hit this pipe, and I take this huge cloud, and I blow it out, and I feel nothing. And I look in the mirror, and I see a reflection. I lean forward, I go like that, and it crawled down my hand. It was a bug, and I looked in the bowl, and the bowl was filled with burnt remnants of bugs. I had just smoked bugs. Now, I will tell you what, that is my sobriety date, May the 23rd, 1991. Now, even though bugs are not really mind-altering substance, it was my intent. And when people say, Terry, you got this great life, what are you most grateful for? I said, bugs don't get you high. Because if they did, I'd be out there right now trying. So now I go to a second detox. And my wife and brother arranged to get me into another detox, 5 more days in detox and into treatment. And on the way to treatment, we're rolling. And as we're heading into treatment, the stark terror of it hit me. And it was, oh my God, I'm going to have to stop. All of it. And that thought terrified me. And the tears started streaming down my face as we pulled into that treatment center. It was called Valley Hope. And I turned to Don and I said, you know, you may not like what comes out of here. Because I had the picture of sober and somber. Greetings, I'm sober. This sucks. So when I said that to her, I said, you know, you may not like what comes out of here. She looked at me and she said, you know, I'm not that crazy about the son of a bitch going in. So I get into there. I start getting busy. I'm busy, and we get in a family group, and they said, hey, is there anything else you want to talk about? I said, yeah. I want to talk about our son, Brandon. Everywhere I go, there's a Brandon. And they looked at us. They go, Brandon, me and Don are sitting side by side. They go, who's Brandon? I don't know what drugs and alcohol did for you, but you're going to hear what they did for me. So we had a three-year-old boy at home named Devin. Beautiful, blue-eyed, wildly fun child. And Donna got pregnant, and the miracle life was unfolding. And she got bigger and bigger, and about the seventh month, one day Donna said to me, I'll tell you what I thought Donna said to me. She said to me, you know, I can't take it anymore. I got to back up. She said, something's wrong and the baby's not moving. So we were going through natural childbirth. Now, I tell this story my way, natural childbirth, because we were kind of hippie counterculture. And how do you tell it?
I turned off my mic because I was coughing. We were too poor to have insurance.
Right. Right. So you follow the story, right?
Because he kept changing jobs.
Right, right. But I was counterculture, right? Because I'm polishing my pig. So back to this deal. So she says to me, what she really said was, well, we went down to the birthing center, and they did an ultrasound. And they came in, they said, Mr. and Mrs. Murphy, we're really sorry, but your son is dead. His name was Brandon. And then they turned to Donna, and they said, ma'am, in keeping with the natural order of things, you need to carry this dead child to term. And your body will tell you when it's time to be rid of the child. So we walked out of the hospital, no clergy, no counselor. Everywhere we go, hey, you gonna teach him to play ball? Is it a boy or a girl? She's out to here. Have you decorated the room yet? And man, all I'm doing is slamming booze and dope like crazy. I can't get enough in me to kill the pain that I am feeling. And so after about a month and a half of that, again, here's what I heard. I heard Donna say to me, you know, they got to induce this child. I can't take it anymore. And what she really said was,
oh, we either go in or I kill myself today.
Yeah. But I had, in my own mind, you understand this pattern of not being able to hear my own truth? That in this, I work it out in my own weird way, right? So what she had said was that they're going to have to do this. So they took us. Now, we're not always the ones wrong. We go to the hospital. They put us right across from the live nursery. And all day long, she's doing Lamaze. Anybody been through that? You know, the breathing. And all day long, people are going to the glass right there to see their babies. And then when my son Brandon was born, they handed my dead son to me, and I backed up and wouldn't take his body. I could never know what she went through. Women are the givers of life. We left the hospital the next day. Our little boy at home wondered what the hell's happened to his life. Why do mom and dad cry all the time now? My wife and my son needed me more than they ever needed me. And the coward that I become behind drugs and alcohol, I fled the state with another woman and left my wife and son. Now you know why I wanted to kill myself? You know, now you know why I got to pour more alcohol, more dope. I got to kill the pain, because anytime a feeling comes up, I pound that stuff down. So we're here to talk about the first three steps. Now, is that powerless? Is that unmanageable? You bet your ass it is. But let me tell you another part of this story, because God's story is written across time. I heard it put this way. Our lives are like a tapestry. You know what a tapestry is on a wall? It's like a beautiful piece of art. And if you look at the backside, it's all muted colors and knots. And they said, our life is like a tapestry woven by God and time on an enchanted loom. But all we ever see is the knots and the dead ends and the seeming bullshit. And so I leave my wife. And I go with this woman, and we were apart for 2.5 years. And every time we get together to discuss the divorce, we'd end up... well, we wouldn't divorce. All right, so... So I'm telling them in this treatment center about Brandon. And they said, well, Devin and Brian, because by then we had gotten back together, had another son, and they knew our boys. And they said, what's this other son? And then I told them about Brandon. I told them the story I just told you. And when we were done, they said, okay, cool, thanks for sharing that with us. Will you do us a favor? I said, sure. And they said, we want you to write Brandon a letter tonight. You know, the Brandon that was sitting here talked about asking yourself, why are you here? You know, this is a good place to write a poem, write a letter, ask yourself in the silence, in the darkness, as we share the language of the heart with each other. That night, me and Donna talked about Brandon for the first time. We never could before because it was too hot to touch, right? So we talked about Brandon. We wrote a letter about that we were in treatment to break the chains of addiction that had bound our family since, and we're here to... I was here to get sober, to be the kind of father to Devin and Brian that I was never able to be for him. And we wrote that letter, man, and the next day we showed up at group, and the counselors and the patients were all there, and they said, do you have the letter? And we said, yeah. And they said, come with us. We're going to have a funeral for your son. They said, have you ever heard of a Dixieland jazz funeral? And we said, nope. And they said, follow this procession. And they all walked out of the room playing invisible horns, and here was the song. Do 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 do. We followed this procession into this chapel in this treatment center in 1991. And we got on our knees in front of this altar, and on the altar was this wooden, simple, plain wooden box. And they said, that's the God box. Put that letter in that God box and bury your son. I kissed the letter. She kissed it. And into the box it went. That didn't solve my alcohol problem. However, it was part of the healing process, because every wound we carry has to be dealt with, and that's what weekends like this are about. But let me fast forward to just a few months ago. That was 33 years ago. And I ended up going back to that treatment center every month and carrying the message for 25 straight years. I would go in once a month, and I talked to every patient through that facility for 25 years. And Donna's been active in her program of recovery. And along the way, something happened. So Donna's sponsoring women in Al-Anon and Co-Anon, and I'm working with addicts and alcoholics. And then this treatment center, they decided to close it after being open for 40 years. They closed it just a few months ago. And Donna's sponsoring the woman who's the manager. Said, hey, what are you going to do with that God box? Just asked the question. Donna asked her, nothing. I went to my Thursday night meeting. I came home from my Thursday night meeting a couple of months ago, and sitting on my counter was the God box that I buried my son in 33 years ago. And I just put my hand on that box, and I wept. Now, let me tell you where the hope in that story is. Is there's tremendous pain in every person's past. That's how we get in these chairs. But yet God heard my cry. And that over 33 years patiently waited. And when I called my sponsor, who's a priest, and I said, you're not going to believe this story, but you know where we buried Brandon in the God box? I now have the God box. And I was thinking just of me and her and our experience. And he said, God chose well when he selected you and Donna to be the keepers of that sacred vessel. Because it's no longer just Brandon's God box. It's every patient over 33 years or the 40 years that place was open, their pain. Because a God can or a God box is when you can't handle the problem, you write it down on paper, when you won't share it with a sponsor, when it's too deep, too painful, too whatever. Put it there and give it to God. And God listens. We've had an amazing experience as time's gone by. I can assure you, an amazing experience, right? We got sober. Things started getting better. We got our first snacks in the house. Getting sober and staying sober is hard, right? Trying to get out of the financial hellhole. I remember the first time we got snacks. I came home. There was Coca-Cola and there was beef jerky. Oh, my God. I sat down. I started eating that jerky. I'm drinking a Coca-Cola. You would have thought, I'm like 6 months, 7 months sober. I'm so happy I'm eating that jerky. And then I turned to Donna. I said, you know, Donna, I'm not complaining, but that jerky's really not that. I wouldn't buy that brand again. It's really not that good. And she looked at me. She goes, well, that's because they're dog treats, honey. She said, I got a coupon for free dog treats. And I looked at her, I said, well, why did you let me eat so many of them? And she said, I didn't want to take away your joy. How elaborate was God's plan? I know this, that God knows me by heart. In my darkest moment of despair, I sat there and I looked at my life and I thought, how am I ever going to get through a good life? You know, I've ruined our finances, I've ruined our life, I've ruined our trust. How am I ever going to get to a better life? And in this meditation, I heard God talk to me. And that's what God does. God's first language is silence. And in the silence of my heart, God spoke. And what he told me is he said, Terry, you don't have to worry about getting Donna to love you again. You don't have to worry about undoing the finances while you're broke and in debt. You don't have to worry about any of that. All you have to do is just one thing. And he held up his finger like I'm doing now, just one thing. And he started poking the palm of his hand like I'm poking. And when you do that, you'll see it gives an indentation. And I'm watching this indentation in the palm of God's hand. And he says, you just keep your relationship with me and your recovery at the center of your life, and I'll take care of the rest. And then I thought, well, what's my part? I'm doing it tonight, and you're doing yours. I could pray, meditate, read the literature, do the steps. Could I make Donna love me? No. Could I bring my dead parents back from the grave? Could I undo all the brokenness, all the... No. But let me tell you, here I sit tonight, 33 years sober. I've done a good job with my one thing. But, oh, wait till you hear over this week, over this weekend, what God has done with his thing. Because God has created a masterfully beautiful life for us. So the last thing I'm going to talk about in step second and third step and then turning it to Donna is this. Sober for a while. Got to learn how to trust God. I don't know how to trust God. You know, I believe there's a power greater than myself. I'm still insane. Just because you get sober doesn't mean they had white rice down there tonight. I was thrilled when I was a few months sober. I go to get some white rice because at the end I would eat a lot of white rice, butter, salt, and pepper. I could hold it down. It didn't make me sick. When I walked in and saw white rice, I knew God was here because I looked. I said to Donna, I go, Donna, there's no white rice. And she said, oh, I'm sorry, I'll pick some up at the store. And I said, no, Donna, you don't get it. If you love me, now I'm 6 months sober, right? There's hope on the horizon. I got a job. Paychecks are coming in. I said, Donna, no white rice? She goes, yeah, I'll pick some up at the store. I said, no, Donna, you don't get it. If you love me, there'd be white rice. I want a divorce. And she goes, you want to divorce me because there's no white rice? And I thought, absolutely. I sure do. She goes, well, you go to your noon meeting. You go to your noon meeting, and when you come back, we'll pick out a divorce attorney. Divide absolutely nothing. And so away I went. But the reason I want to share that, it was my first miracle, because I went to a meeting instead of to the dope house or to the bar, and I came back and I made amends. And then while we're doing better, we get checks in the mail. All of a sudden, we're so broke, but there's just enough to get by. And I go to the mailbox one day, and I see in the corner, it says Utah. That's where I led with that woman. And I took the bill and did a dope fiend move, stuck it in my pocket. I got to work that day. I opened it up. It's a collection notice from the apartment I moved in with this woman. Now, we don't have money to buy groceries to feed our kids. How am I going to now face this? So I call up, I go, oh, you've got the wrong person. I live in Arizona, I'm Terry Murphy. If I hear from you again, you'll hear from my attorney. Click. And then all day long, oh, I tore the bill up in a bunch of pieces. All day long, I kept hearing, that's the same old shit. So I called my sponsor. He said, I don't know what to do. He said, call your grand. I called my grand sponsor, and he said, what do you want to do, dude? I said, I think I got to face it. So the very next day, I called. And I told the woman, I said, ma'am, I lied. And she went, I know you lied. So I told her I'm in a 12-step program. She said, I'm in one too. There were two people on this bill. It was $3,600. It's now $18. She goes, I have authorization to drop by 50%. It's now $900. Can you send me $900? I said, ma'am, I couldn't send you $9. And she goes, can you send a $25 payment each month? And I thought, sure, I can. This second step right here, I can do that. 25, I can get the 25 bucks. They give salesman spiffs. I can sneak the 25. And then I thought, no, that's the same old shit. So that night I went home and I faced Donna. And I said, Donna, the very worst thing that could have happened at the very worst time. But I knew my marriage was hanging by a thread, but I knew if I didn't trust God with that, I couldn't trust, you know, that God couldn't trust me with this. And when I was done telling her, she said, thank you for sharing that. And Donna sent the first $25 payment. And everyone after it, out of our slim paychecks. And the last thing I'll tell you is about surrender. So I know what it's like to be in the third step. I know what it's like to make a surrender. Every day, the most important surrender is not the one that I made after smoking those bugs. The most important surrender was the one I made this morning when I hit my knees. But I made a big one night. I was 6 years sober. My life's falling apart. Our son's getting loaded. Our beautiful son had now grown into an alcoholic and an addict. And all hell was breaking loose at home, and my heart was breaking. And I was sitting in my meeting, and I didn't know what to do with this feeling. I was so pissed off at God. It was like, God, I can't believe you are doing this to me. You know, I go to jails and institutions and carry the message and help others. How could you do this to me? And I'm in a meeting. I heard God speak again. He said, Terry, you gave me your problem with drugs and alcohol. Give me your son. And that night, I get to meetings early, stay late. That night, I hauled ass home. I went to the dark bedroom. I got on my knees in the bedroom where I pray every morning and every night. And I gave my son, Devin, to God the same way I begged God to enter my heart, to stop me from smoking and drinking. And God did exactly what God does. A few days later, our son came to us and said, hey, I'd like to go to this program. I think I'm struggling with something. So the point I want to make is when you stay engaged in these steps, somehow, when I stay engaged in things like retreats, the opportunity to heal just seems to avail itself to us. So today, that son who was destroying himself, who every night I walk down the hall to see that he killed himself, was it a suicide, an overdose? That same son is 41 years old and beautiful beyond belief. And he gave us our first granddaughter. And so now I'm going to turn it to my smoking hot wife.
Now that I have, 12 minutes? So there's a running joke of how long I'll speak and how long he'll speak with everybody back home. So And I think you figured it out already. So, and who wouldn't want to stay married to you after hearing your story? So, as he alluded to, we partied a lot together. So I meet this guy, and, you know, and I know a little bit about alcoholism because my grandma was, she was, you know, the movie Throw Mama from the Train and Goonies, that crotchety old lady, man, she was my grandma. She chain-smoked, sat on the sofa, and cussed at us all the time drinking beer. So that's what that was my vision of what an alcoholic was. He was fun. He wasn't grandma. He's not sitting on the couch. He's fun. And so, you know, and he was honest. He told me he was used to be a heroin addict. And I'm thinking, God, this guy's really strong. He just, you know, not knowing a damn thing. He's not doing heroin, right? So he's good. He's good. We're doing cocaine. We're drinking. It's good. You know, acid every once in a while. You know, I'm not an alcoholic addict, but I partied really hard. And the difference between, for me, between someone who abuses drugs and alcohol and somebody who is truly an addict is when we decided to, I'm going to kind of jump forward in our story, when we got back from Texas, you know, where he was talking about losing everything, moving back in with my mom and dad, we decided that it was, we should have a child, right? Because we have no home. They hooked our cars in the middle of the night. We have no cars. And he's new on a job and a career that he had never done before. Perfect time to have a child. So, you know, we talked about it. We both really, really wanted this. We'd been married for 4 years, something like that. And we thought, okay, we're going to stop doing drugs. Occasional bottle of wine. We're going to be, you know, no more parties. We're going to grow up. We're going to be grown-ups now. And we both truly, truly meant it, you know, and I believe to the bottom of his soul he meant it. He was totally incapable. And I stopped doing drugs, you know. And so that, for me, is truly the difference between someone like me and an addict alcoholic. Now, I am not silly enough to think that if I keep doing drugs that I won't cross that line. So, you know, I do understand the difference, and I do understand there is a line for people like me that I can cross and become an addict. So, you know, man, so much to cover in so little time. you know, where the insanity that he talks about took me, it took, you know, we split up. And he didn't get sober after we split up. I become suicidal. So, you know, I've lost this child. My marriage is on the rocks. I've got this amazing child at home, and I don't want to live anymore because my life wasn't how I planned it to be. You know, I had this great life with, you know, I grew up in a family, even though grandma was an alcoholic, there was no, and she ended up dying of wet brain later on in life. So both of my grandparents died of the disease of alcoholism. And, you know, that wasn't what I wanted in my life. I didn't want the chaos and the destruction, but that's where it had taken us. And so I end up going through counseling, kind of find myself again and found my joy and my happiness. And he's always hanging around, checking things out every once in a while. And, you know, we end up getting back together. And, you know, he's still, you know, it's like this. You know, it gets better, it gets worse, it gets better, it gets worse. I get pregnant again. And I hear, and, you know, the wheels are falling off. I'm not going down that dark hole again. I'm just not. So I start planning my escape. And I know that the way we are, I have to leave. I can't stay in the same state or in the same town with him because I know he's going to die on my front doorstep. And I can't have my kids go through this. So I make all these plans. I'm done threatening. Oh, my God. You know what it's like. you make the ultimatums, and the ultimatums mean nothing, because as soon as that line's crossed, you know, I'm mad for a day, whatever, and then life starts over again. So I know that I have to leave town. And so I'm going to go. My parents had moved a couple hours away, so I'd planned I was going to go move up there. I'm waiting for school to be out, and I'm going to leave while he's at work. And, you know, because our life, you know, the unmanageability of what happened to those two young people that were just having fun. And, you know, and now it's just complete madness. And so I make my plans, getting everything ready. I had an insurance check coming in from the business that we had together. And, you know, he checks himself into rehab. Oh, shit, now I can't leave. You know, I loved him, but I wasn't in love with him. You know, that part of me was gone. But I can't leave now because he's in rehab, you know. And so what do you do with all that anger, that resentment, that craziness that's going on inside my head while he's trying to get clean and sober? And I don't want to ruin his chances, you know. And that's what kept going through my mind. If I leave, he doesn't have a chance, you know. So I stay. And you know, he was talking about driving into Valley Hope. And on the way there, he's telling me everything that I've done wrong to screw our life up. And, you know, how I've mismanaged our funds. That was a good one. That one almost got me. How I wasn't raising our children properly. And all I heard in my head very loudly was God saying, do not talk. Shh. And I knew that if I pulled up to a stop light and I picked up the rope and I started arguing with him, that would give him the perfect excuse to get out of that car. And so, you know, it's funny. I don't know about you, but every once in a while, God has just, like, grabbed hold of my brain and said, don't. And then, of course, we get into the parking lot, and he says those lovely words. And I continued to tell him how much I didn't like him. Because we were safe. We were in the parking lot. Now I could say I don't like the person I'm dropping off. And, you know, so I grew up with this incredible, loving relationship with my higher power. You know, we went to church every Sunday. I had a very loving vision of what God was like. But over the years, you know, with partying and the things we did, it was, to me, it was like putting God up on a shelf. And then after a while, I put a couple of books on the shelf. You know, he's kind of back in the corner now. And so this God that I had growing up, I no longer depended on. And the more our life got crazy, the more I shut down and the less I talked about what was going on. Because when I tell people what's going on in my household, they all have this wonderful advice that's like, you should leave, you should, you know, I should discipline him more, like he's an adult. You know, I'm either too kind, I'm too mean, I'm too. I'm the problem. I'm the problem here. So if I'm the problem, I should be the solution, right? And so, you know, I just stopped talking to people. I'm not telling people what's going on in our household. And I'm not trusting God with any of it because I want my outcome to be my outcome. And God may not give me the outcome that I want. So I'm not talking to God either. And, you know, so he gets into rehab, and I'm sitting there and I'm angry and I don't know if I care about this person at all. I just don't want him to die because I don't want our kids to not have a father. And, you know, I just sit there and I realize I've got to find some kind of a relationship. And so, you know, I start going to open meetings. Oh, I got to tell you my Al-Anon story. So the treatment center, now you got to remember, when he got sober, there's no internet, there's no cell phones. I couldn't even track him. Man, you guys are so lucky now. You can track people. You know, I couldn't track him. I used to have to put the kids in the car and go find him. Like that made any difference, but you know, in my brain it did. And yeah, technology's great. You can see when they're taking money out of the account. I felt so sorry for this one woman who had to have worked the night shift at the bank, because you could call and find out what your balance was. And I would see the money chipping away out of the account. And that woman, it was the same voice almost every time I called. And I wish I could find her and make amends to her. Because, you know, it had to break her heart. It had to break her heart, because I know it was breaking mine. And I lost my train of thought here. You know, so here I am. I'm just so lost. And so I start going to open meetings with him. And I hear the hope. I hear the laughter. And when I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, that was where I was going, the treatment center said, hey, you know, you should probably go to a couple meetings. And so they said, oh, there's one we think over here. So I found it and I went there. And I didn't hear hope. It wasn't a good meeting. And it's so, so important to me that every meeting that I go to, whether it's my home group meeting or it's a meeting I've never been to, I introduce myself to people. I talk to them. It's so, so important not to get stuck talking to the people that you know and not reach out to the people that you don't know in that meeting, because I felt so apart from. And like I said, I didn't hear the hope. I heard a lot of, well, you'll get off your pink cloud, you know. And it's important, the message that we give in our meetings. Now, fast forward, I've met some of the founding members of Al-Anon that were in it before it was even Al-Anon, the AAA, and oh man, what a beautiful, beautiful program of love. But so I start, you know, going to meetings. I get the hope that I hear in the meetings. I hear the laughter. There was no laughter in our home towards the end. It was pretty much silence. I was done yelling. I was done. I was just done. And, you know, it's funny because for the longest time, everybody, when I would go to meetings, they always thought I was an alcoholic addict. And I'm like, no, you know, because I went for so long without going to recovery program for myself that they just thought I was one of them, which was great, because I always felt like I should stand up and get a newcomer chip every other week. you know, I heard that I could redefine what I needed for a higher power. And, you know, the God that I had growing up was a childhood God. And, you know, happy, you know, Jesus loves me, ah, but not really the God that you go to when you're life is falling apart and you're broken and you're so, so broken. You know, I didn't know that God could help with that. And, you know, I got to develop this amazing relationship with the higher power. And it's really cool. I also have a ex-Baptist minister brother who thinks I'm going to hell. So, because I don't have the right God, according to him. But that's okay. I keep telling him. He says he prays for me every day, and I tell him to keep praying. I can use all the prayers that I can get. So, you know, with that, I just, I'm so, so grateful for this program. This program has changed absolutely every relationship in my life. Not only my relationship to him, my relationship to my children. You'll hear later my relationship to my parents. And, oh, I also tear up a lot, but I had surgery on my eyes, so I tear up even more than normal. You know, it's just an amazing, you know, if you, you know, like they were talking about earlier, if you come all the way in and sit down, this will change every aspect of your life, you know, bar none, you know. And I remember our son, the youngest of the two, one day, he was probably about 10, and he picked up the 12 steps, and he said, well, what's this? And I said, well, this is the 12 steps that we work. And he looks at it and goes, pfft. He goes, that's like everybody should live like this. And I went, yep. You know, so it's you know, I can't. I am just so. I feel sorry for people who don't have a program, and don't work the 12 steps, and don't have a higher power, and they just exist on this plane, and because there's so much more than just existing in this world. You know, there's so much more. And with that, I will pass. And I did pretty good.
You did fabulous. Okay, cool. So we get to see all of you tomorrow. We got music coming up. And then tomorrow we'll go on 4 and 5. Don will go first.
We did it that way on purpose so that we could switch back and forth. So maybe I could get more than 4 words in.
By the way, here I'd like to close with this last stop before we go to meet. I wish y'all could have been there when we were sitting there with our adult sons, and they said to us, "Mom and Dad, what did you guys like to do when you were younger?" And I looked at them, I said, "Well, your mother's favorite thing was to drop acid and go to the Muppet movies."